concerns of workplace safety and claims of retaliation at Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
Alaska's only state-run psychiatric hospital is found to have an unsafe work environment. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a controversial change to Fairbanks labor contracts.
What we heard at the meeting was there are certainly some things that we think could be improved in the code.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska's only state-run psychiatric hospital is an unsafe place to work. That's the finding of a report by an independent investigation commissioned by the state of Alaska. At a press conference in Anchorage today, Attorney General Jonna Lindemuth said the state took up troubling allegations about the facility last March.
To look at concerns of workplace safety and claims of retaliation at Alaska Psychiatric Institute, API.
The state hired a private law firm to investigate three main issues: whether API employees are safe at work, whether there is retaliation by management against employees, and if the facility is a hostile work environment. Attorney Bill Evans wrote the report after conducting confidential interviews with current and former staff, as well as reviewing past surveys and investigations of API. As recently as last year, state labor officials found a number of safety violations at the facility. Evans' own conclusion is that several factors make it dangerous to work at API.
So I focused my report primarily on finding those underlying reasons that may be affecting safety in the workplace, things that could be controlled perhaps by the administration.
The report cites nearly a dozen factors hindering employee safety. They include problems with scheduling, inadequate training for entry-level employees, insufficient programming for patients, no intensive care unit, and a lack of consequences for patients who physically assault staff. Evans also investigated claims of retaliation against employees who raise safety concerns and that API is a hostile work environment. He did not find sufficient evidence that either charge is happening in a systematic way, though conceded there are individual incidents that might have contributed to that perception. By some measures, API has roughly half the number of beds that the state needs. Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson says more than a decade ago, when the facility was built, the intent was to replace institutional care with community-based resources. But Davidson says that hasn't happened.
Anytime you have a demonstrated need of 160 beds and you instead end up with a facility that has 80, it's just a matter of time before those problems are going to come to the forefront.
Davidson says her department and the Walker administration are taking a number of immediate steps to improve the situation. They're raising wages for nurses to make the job competitive with nearby hospitals. They're also partnering with other state entities to examine how to fund more treatment beds. If the Walker administration remains in place after the November election, it will make new requests for legislative funding for facility improvements, more staff positions, and more treatment spots. A political consultant has died while his work was being scrutinized amid allegations of voter fraud in a close Anchorage State House race. That's according to the state representative who hired him. Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media has more.
Charlie Chang worked with Gabrielle Ledoux, a Republican whose district includes parts of the Muldoon neighborhood and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Chang helped Ledoux recruit Hmong voters, and Ledoux's opponents tied him to what they described as irregular absentee voting patterns. Ledoux says Chang died Tuesday from a major stroke after he was on life support for a couple of days. His death was first reported by Anchorage TV station KTUU. Ledoux caucuses with Democrats in the House's majority coalition, and the Alaska Republican Party has been trying to unseat her. She trailed her Republican primary opponent, Aaron Weaver, by 3 votes after the first round of counting on election night. A subsequent count of absentee ballots gave Ledoux a 117-vote win. But state elections officials also say that they found evidence of voter fraud among the absentee ballots, and they've sent their findings to prosecutors for investigation. The officials say they received absentee applications in the names of 7 dead people. Those ballots were not mailed, but officials also identified 26 suspicious ballots that were returned, and all 26 of those votes went to Ledoux. The state hasn't released details about the voters who sent in those suspicious ballots, but Ledoux's Republican opponents point to more than 24 people with Hmong last names who registered to vote from 2 different Muldoon mobile homes. And they point out that Ledoux paid Chang more than $10,000 to recruit Hmong voters. Ledoux says she told Chang to be careful and that she had no reason to believe he broke any laws. State prosecutors have declined to comment about a possible voter fraud investigation, and they did not immediately respond to questions today about how their work could be affected by Chang's death. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
The Alaska Federation of Natives says it opposes the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. AFN's statement today comes as the Senate considers confirming President Trump's pick for a lifetime appointment to the High Court. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski has met with Kavanaugh and said she would be mulling over his record. Murkowski's positions on abortion rights and willingness in the past to break from her fellow Republicans makes her a potential key vote in Kavanaugh's confirmation. Murkowski has enjoyed strong support from the Alaska Federation of Natives, and many credit her historic 2010 general election win through a write-in campaign to support from Alaska Native voters, at least in part. AFN says it opposes Kavanaugh on the basis of his statements or decisions on Native rights cases, as well as concern that he is more conservative than current justices whose positions on Native rights could be disastrous for Alaska. Today in Brazil, at a meeting of the International Whaling Commission, Alaska bowhead whale hunters celebrated a big victory. The organization, which manages international whaling, including for indigenous hunters, voted to change the way that subsistence hunt quotas are set. Instead of quotas that expire and have to be renewed by the full IWC every 6 years, the quotas will now be renewed automatically, provided that they have approval from the scientific committee that reviews the health of different whale populations. It will also enable hunters to carry over more of their unused allowance from past years to another year. Members of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission are attending the meeting in Brazil as part of the U.S. delegation. The meeting ends Friday. The IWC began setting quotas for the Alaska bowhead whale subsistence hunt back in 1977. Under a draft plan released this summer, commercial fishermen in southeast Alaska would get only a small portion of the $56.3 million appropriated by Congress to address a pink salmon disaster in 2016. However, workers at seafood processing plants that year could be in line for some of the money as well. Joe Vicknicki reports.
A year and a half ago, the U.S. Commerce Secretary declared the 2016 pink salmon season across the Gulf of Alaska a fishery failure due to unusual ocean and climate conditions. The state of Alaska and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have come up with a draft spending plan for how to allocate that money to fishermen, processors, municipalities, and researchers. The money will be paid out by an agency called the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. Sebastian O'Kelly is a lobbyist in the nation's capital. His clients include the Petersburg Borough and that commission. O'Kelly briefed the Petersburg Borough Assembly on the spending plan at a meeting in early September.
I want to talk a little bit about the allocation and the breakout and the criteria that will be used in distributing the relief, because you will have fishermen, processors, and the borough itself as active participants and recipients of this funding.
The draft plan allocates $4.1 million for pink salmon research, including work to estimate the annual numbers of young salmon migrating from streams to sea. More than half of the money, $32 million, will be paid to commercial fishermen, and specifically permit holders who fished in 2016. Over $20 million of that would go to fleets in Prince William Sound, nearly $7 million to Kodiak fishermen, and $2.1 million to Southeast Alaska permit holders. That's based on the value of catches in 2016 and how those compare to average catch values for those regions. In addition, O'Kelly explained $17.7 million would go to processing companies that operated that year.
The processors will have to show their loss for that year, and they have to have a plan for allocation of 75% of the amount that individual processor receives to the processing workforce. So this is a new... I've been around a lot of fisheries disasters. This is the first time I've seen those decisions made. So this will be a new process. So it'll probably take a little bit of while to sort out.
Another $2.4 million would be paid out to municipalities like Petersburg, where pink salmon were landed in 2016. Public comment on the plan will be taken until 5 o'clock on September 18th. Assemblymember Eric Castro questioned O'Kelly about whether he expected there would be a disaster declaration for this year's pink salmon run, which is less than half of the 2016 catch in Southeast. O'Kelly explained it would likely take another two-year process, including a disaster request and funding from Congress.
The combination of all of these things, I'm giving you a very long-winded answer here, kind of explains why this process moves kind of about 2 years behind when an actual disaster occurs. But the short answer is yes.
The pink salmon catch this year is expected to be the lowest in Southeast in over four decades. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a typhoon in the Pacific has Guam-based B-52s parked at Eielson Air Force Base.
This is a monstrous, very scary-looking storm with sustained winds of 155 miles per hour.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
The Fairbanks City Council this week passed an ordinance that changes the way labor contracts are negotiated. With tight budgets and some labor contracts pending, the change is controversial, as KUAC's Robin reports.
The ordinance amends the Fairbanks General Code for Labor Relations and Negotiations. It was supposed to be an innocuous housekeeping measure with small updates written mostly by the city attorney, Paul Ewers. Ewers says he cleaned up obsolete wording of the code and made it more readable and understandable. But by the time it had its public hearing in August, the ordinance to change the code brought attention to the code itself and the entire process the city uses to negotiate. The Central Labor Council organized a town meeting on September 4th to examine the ordinance and the code. Mindy O'Neill is an organizer for Laborers Local 942.
What we heard at the meeting was there are certainly some things that we think could be improved in the code. And if this was an opportunity to tighten up the code or to make it work better for both the city and the workers, then that was an opportunity we wanted to participate in.
The Fairbanks Firefighters Association, the Public Safety Employees Association, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Operators 302, Laborers Local 942, and the AFL-CIO represent different groups of city workers. Jennifer Juhas is a professional consultant to negotiators. She says a full rewrite of the code is needed, not just an update.
It would be fantastic for the city council to take this opportunity to really lead this issue and truly doing some housekeeping, not just sweeping a few cobwebs, but opening it up and going, like I said, room by room to take a look and make sure each room is clean before we go on to the next section.
One of the weaknesses of the code was no clause saying that the council should get financial information about pending contracts, which the city attorney said led to surprises, such as the police contract in 2014, which started 4 years of litigation. The ordinance now has that update. Council members June Rogers, Valerie Therrien, and Joy Huntington argued for postponing the ordinance until the council could meet with the already engaged citizens in a work session to overhaul the law about labor negotiations. In the council chambers with noisy heat pipes, Huntington said it was an opportunity.
It's our duty as a council to work with the community. I think there's this opportunity for building relationships and building trust, and you know, it really does begin with being transparent and coming together.
The council defeated the motion to postpone the ordinance 3-3, with the tie being broken by Mayor Jim Matherly. Then the council passed the ordinance 5-1. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta has one of the highest suicide rates in the country, and Mountain Village is a place where suicide attempts are common. As in many villages, the first responder is often a village or tribal police officer. KYUK's Teresa Kratzarillis rode along with one Mountain Village VPO whose quick thinking helps keep her neighbors alive. And just a quick note, this report might be disturbing for some listeners.
It's Friday night in Mountain Village, and Village Police Officer Anna Bill is trying to stay awake.
And it's only starting. And I'm on 1 hour of sleep.
Anna's a potty-mouthed mother of four who's been a VPO for a little under a year. Last night, she received 39 calls in about 4 hours. We were just sitting down to a family potluck when she got a call about another assault, and we're not wasting any time getting there. Anna and another VPO walk briskly into a small house. After a while, Anna jogs back out and gets on her phone.
We'll get her to the clinic, okay?
The woman inside has tried to kill herself.
She's gonna be okay.
Within minutes, a group of city employees veer into the front yard on four-wheelers. Mountain Village's city manager runs into the house. They need help carrying the woman out. The woman's fighting them, but Anna and the others manage to haul her into the back of a battered pickup with a broken door. That's the closest thing Mountain Village has to an ambulance.
Are you guys ready?
A few men jump in the back of the pickup to hold the woman down and keep her from rolling out the back. Anna swerves down the hill towards Mountain Village's small health clinic.
This makes 54 different people.
54 people in the last 7 months. About 850 people live in Mountain Village, and according to the city's police records, between 5 and 7% of them have attempted suicide in the past year. Anna has helped save them all. She's responded to as many as 3 suicide attempts a day. She's cut several people down who've tried to hang themselves. Anna never thought that she'd be doing this. As a teenager in Mountain Village, she actually threw eggs at one of the village's old VPOs, along with a few girlfriends she still refuses to rat out. She was that kid. So when a former VPO offered Anna the job, she prayed on it. Then she put in her application and got to work the same day.
At 5 o'clock that evening, I got sworn in and my shift started at midnight.
Anna didn't receive any training in suicide response or in anything else. She doesn't have a uniform and didn't have any handcuffs until a trooper lent her some. She's also miserably paid.
Who wants to risk their life for $13 an hour? Me!
She actually makes about $15 an hour now. Anna used to work in behavioral health, but when it comes to responding to suicide attempts, she's mostly taught herself by listening back to old calls.
There's some signs I wish that I could have noticed on some suicide calls. You can't blame yourself for it, but it's really hard not to do.
Anna keeps a bullet on her desk. It's a round from the shotgun that was used in the first suicide attempt she responded to. She talked the man down, but kept the bullet as a reminder that things can go bad quickly. She tells the growing number of people she's helped save that they can call or text her at any time.
It's a bond that a normal person wouldn't be able to see. An invisible connection, I should say. It's like a connection from me to the next person and the next person. It's like a chain reaction. And it's just, you know, I'll look at them and they'll look at me and I'll know, you know, they'll just nod and I'll know that they're okay.
The woman who tried to kill herself is safe in Mountain Village's clinic. Anna's running an errand when the phone rings.
Mountain Village Police Department. Okay, bye. Oh, we got another suicide attempt.
The calls from the same house we visited earlier. This time, it's the woman's brother. He's upset, but he hasn't tried to hurt himself. His family was afraid he would. He's calm, eating dinner. They talk for a while, and then Anna gets back in the car. She says the brother struggles with alcohol, and she's had to arrest him several times. He's actually taken a swing at her before. This is progress.
What? I'm tired.
By the time we get home, Anna's exhausted. Her boyfriend, Ivan, fixes her some food.
Every time I deal with any kind of suicide attempts, I'll have no energy. I'll feel really sick. You know, it takes a lot out of me. I attempted suicide when I was young. I tried to take a handful of pills and survived.
That was when Anna was 16. She says she woke up in Bethel's hospital thinking about her family. She says the experience makes her better at dealing with people on these calls.
I talk to a lot of these kids and I tell them, you know, I've been there. I felt what you felt. I've been through it and I did it before, but look, I'm here and now I'm trying to make a difference.
And on Anna's watch, among all of these attempts, no one has died from suicide. In Mountain Village, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
That was part one of a four-part series on suicide and treatment in Mountain Village. Part two and three are available at kyuk.com. Also, if you or one of your loved ones is struggling with suicidal thoughts, please call the Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Every week, the Chickaloon Tribal Council is the little town south, in the little town of Sutton, hosts a community meal. Dozens of people show up, and not just for the food. It's a small event that has big consequences. Reporter Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk brings us the story of what makes it possible for little organizations to accomplish big changes.
It's lunchtime on a Thursday in midsummer in Sutton. In the small community center, at the weekly elders' lunch, people of all ages gather for food and conversation. As the meal winds down, local people make community announcements.
I just want to remind everybody that on the 17th...
And kids celebrate their summer camp accomplishments.
And we made a cloud in a jar.
And they made a cloud in a jar.
Which was cool.
Guys, let's show them.
Lisa Wade with Chickaloon Tribal Council says in winter, it's standing room only, every week. But the elders' lunches in Chickaloon weren't always such a success. They required lots of collaboration to get going, just like the rest of the services in the community. Wade says the Chickaloon Tribal Council started the lunches about a decade ago because elders said they wanted a place to come together, talk, tell stories.
We would all bring food. We used to have a one little burner stove with broken burners over here. And we would just make something and bring a pot of something and we'd ask other people to bring a dish. And for 2 years, we had people donating food and bringing food here.
Eventually, the tribe got small grants to provide food and to improve the kitchen. Slowly, lunches expanded from a handful of folks to dozens. Now it's a place for community news and education. The elders' lunches are just a small example of how community leaders are leveraging partnerships to strengthen the village of 1,500 people and beyond. Wade says Chickaloon is a relatively small tribe, so they only receive limited funding from the federal government.
We are masters of figuring out how to spread a dollar a long ways. It's like being from a big family and making a meal, you know, you stretch that meal out.
They can't do everything that larger cities and organizations can. But on the flip side, larger groups have to follow more guidelines and can't be everywhere. So working in tandem, they can meet people's needs.
A lot of the larger entities don't have the boots on the ground to actually do the local work that needs to be done. And we can do things in a little bit more of a flexible way that actually meets more of the needs, I think, of the community directly.
And they don't do it alone. Take, for example, health and wellness. The Tribal Council can create community events and provide social workers, but they don't have the technical skills and infrastructure to provide medical care. So they hired South Central Foundation to help run the clinic. But rather than just supplying the community with medical expertise, South Central Vice President Doug Eby says his organization works collaboratively with the tribe and with the local advisory board to make sure what they are doing fits local needs.
We want to follow their lead and partner with them when there's difficult issues or difficult situations because it's their community. We are a guest in their community.
Wade says Chickaloon isn't just supporting partnerships for its own benefits. They also try to build capacity and support the initiatives of other tribes, like the Kinnick Tribal Council. Kinnick Tribal Council Executive Director Richard Porter says they partner on nearly everything and try to avoid providing redundant services. Instead of competing against each other for grants, they collaborate.
Our mission statement has the mention of us being a sovereign nation, but also says that we're striving for a healthy community and making sure that happens with working very closely with our neighbors. If your neighbors aren't healthy, then you have a tendency not to be healthy also.
Porter says that doesn't mean the tribes always agree. They have very different ideas about topics like energy development. He says they support each other, but sometimes they just have to agree to disagree. They're like siblings, he says. Family. And it's that feeling of family and support that brings folks like Francis Thiel back to the Chickaloon Elders Lunch week after week for years.
People. They're so wonderful, friendly, loving atmosphere. Couldn't go anywhere else and find it.
As the lunch winds down and the announcements end, an elder pulls out his guitar and invites people to join him.
Sit by my side if you love.
For the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Five B-52 bombers from a U.S. airbase in Guam are parked on the flight line at Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks. Air Force officials sent the big bombers and their crews to Eielson this week to wait out Typhoon Mangkhut, which struck the island on Monday. Forecasters said Mangkhut had grown stronger after it had spun away from Guam en route to Asia. An Eielson spokesperson said Tuesday the five bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana had been deployed to Anderson Air Base in Guam as part of a routine deployment. The B-52s are assigned to the 96th Bomb Squadron from Barksdale. Eielson officials say they're not sure how long the B-52s will remain at Eielson. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Nat Herz in Anchorage, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ravenna Koenig, Robin and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Teresa Katsarilis in Mountain Village, and Ann Hillman in Chickaloon. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.